This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Peace talks underway. The Afghan government and the Taliban are trying to end 20 years of war. At the negotiating table, four women.
It's not easy work. We feel a kind of a heavy responsibility on our shoulder.
I'm Marco Werman, and in Lebanon, is the government even listening to the people?
Well, I mean, for government to listen to the people, you need to have a government to begin with, and we don't have one right now.
Political stalemate in Beirut. And in Belarus, an opposition leader has a message for Americans.
Value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world.
And in a lockdown in Verona, we set our scene. A happy ending this time, delivered in iambic pentameter. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's good to have you with us today. President Trump has been pretty clear. He wants to end the war in Afghanistan and bring the troops home. Peace talks are now underway. The Afghan government and the Taliban are meeting face-to-face in Qatar. Back in Afghanistan, plenty of women are worried that their hard-earned rights could be lost if the Taliban comes back to power. The Afghan government's negotiating team includes a handful of women. The World's Shirin Jafari spoke with two of them.
The talks are taking place in a giant hotel ballroom in the Qatari capital, Doha. On the opening day, there was a huge TV screen on the wall with the words Afghanistan peace negotiations across it, and even some mood music in the background. Back when the Taliban ruled Afghanistan in the 1990s, music like this, or any music, in fact, would have been banned. The Taliban follow a strict version of Islam, and fear is what many women remember of the years they were in power. Now, Habiba Sarabi says sitting face-to-face with the group's leaders brings up lots of emotions.
Yeah, we were not nervous, but we came here with a lot of responsibility.
Sarabi is one of four women on the Afghan negotiating team with about 20 men.
It's not easy work. We feel a kind of a heavy responsibility on our shoulder.
Heavy responsibility, because back home, women are counting on Sarabi and her colleagues to safeguard what they've achieved in the past two decades. Today, women in Afghanistan can hold public office. Sarabi herself is an example of that. She was the first woman to be elected governor. She also served as the Minister of Women's Affairs and Minister of Education. But Sarabi says today, the prospect of a hardline Taliban comeback looms large.
Mentality, no, they are not different. There is no difference between this Taliban and the Taliban in the 90s. On the behavior, we can see a little bit change on that.
Afghans are watching closely, she says. They're looking for signs that could reveal what the new Taliban mindset is. In a recent TV interview, Taliban spokesman Mohammad Naeem Bardak refused to make eye contact with the reporter, Narges Hurakhsh. Viewers immediately took to social media to comment. Some said it's a sign that the group hasn't changed at all, that it still views women as less than. But others said the interview was promising, that it showed a Taliban representative willing to sit down with a woman on camera. Still, so far, 10 days into the negotiations, the two sides have only discussed procedural matters. Essentially, they've been talking about the talks. Sharifa Zormati Wardak is taking part in the negotiations. She tells me from Doha that the slow progress shows just how much mistrust and skepticism there is. She says her team is staying in separate buildings from the Taliban, but that they do bump into each other from time to time outside of formal settings. Back in Afghanistan, the violence continues. Just this week, as the two sides were getting ready to meet in Doha, a local official in Zermati's province was shot dead. There is no question, she says. We want an immediate ceasefire. People of Afghanistan are tired of the bloodshed, she goes on to tell me. It's time to stop the killing. But the Taliban say they're not ready to agree to a ceasefire. Zermati says since she came to Doha, her phone has been ringing nonstop. She gets messages from people back home asking how the talks are going. So far, she doesn't have much progress to report. I ask her what she thinks about the process taking so long. Every day we ask, when are we going to start talking about the real issues, she says. But listen, we're Afghans. We've been at war for 40 years. What's a couple of more days to start talking about peace? For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
The last couple of weeks, the world has been bringing you coverage of the crisis that migrants are facing on the Greek island of Lesbos. 12,500 migrants and asylum seekers lost their homes, lost pretty much everything, after a fire razed the Moria refugee camp there. The European Union is watching closely. How to handle asylum and migration has been a divisive issue in the EU. Today, though, the EU tried to put forward a solution, a mandatory pact that would affect all 27 EU countries. EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen called it a sustainable solution.
Migration is complex. The old system to deal with it in Europe no longer works.
So what's in that plan and what impact would it have across Europe? The world's Lydia Emanuelidou joins us from Lesbos in Greece. What exactly would this pact require countries to do, Lydia?
It would require that all countries in the EU pitch in to help manage migration and asylum in some way. So countries would either have to take people in, relocate migrants and refugees to their countries, or if they don't want to do that, they'd be required to help return those whose applications are rejected to their home countries. Initially, Marco, there had been some talk of instituting mandatory quotas, so each country having to host a certain number of migrants and refugees. But some countries like Hungary and Poland have strongly opposed that. So what came out today was a compromise.
What else is the EU Commission proposing to do to the asylum process?
Yeah, a couple other things they want to do is, one, speed up the asylum procedure so that once people make it to the EU, they're not waiting here indefinitely. And another thing they want to do is beef up border security. So toughen screenings and checks at the border, and not just within the EU, but at the countries where people are coming from.
From the perspective of the EU Commission, what is the intention of the plan?
Well, Marco, there were two words that commissioners kept repeating at the press conference today: solidarity and responsibility. So EU Commission Vice President Margaritis Skinias, he's Greek, said it's unthinkable that the EU still doesn't have a cohesive migration and asylum policy.
We have learned the lessons of 2016 and the failure of the European Union to foster an agreement then is very present with us. That's why we need to start with everyone on board and everyone around the table.
So he's talking about, you know, Europe at the height of the migrant crisis in 2015, 2016. And in terms of responsibility, commissioners said today that managing migration and asylum shouldn't fall to just a few countries. So for years now, countries here in southern Europe, like Greece, where I am, have been on the front line of this crisis because of their geography. They've been disproportionately affected by the influx of migrants, and they've accused northern European countries, which also, by the way, tend to be richer, of not doing their part. So this pact also tries to address that and to take some of the burden off of Greece and other countries in this region.
What are you hearing from advocacy groups and NGOs? What's their reaction to this EU proposal?
Many people are not pleased at all with this pact. They say it totally misses the mark. I spoke earlier today with Marissa Ryan. She heads the EU office for Oxfam, which is an international group of 20 NGOs.
What's coming out from the Commission today looks like the lowest common denominator for us. We're seeing much more emphasis on returns. We're seeing moves towards ensuring that overseas development assistance is spent on border control rather than poverty eradication. And we have no guarantees that what is being announced is actually going to protect and make a meaningful difference in the lives of people who are fleeing for their lives.
Lydia, as you think about this plan the EU has proposed and you think about some of the people who lost their homes in the fire at Moria, I mean, does it feel like the EU plan could be what they need?
Well, from what I've seen on the ground, Marco, ever since the Moria fire, 12,000 people were on the streets. They didn't have basic things like shelter, food, water. They've now been moved into a new camp, and they tell me that a lot of those conditions are still ongoing. There are now hundreds of cases of coronavirus in the camp. So I think right now a lot of these people are thinking about, one, having their immediate needs met, and also having their asylum applications processed so they can leave this island. A lot of people have been here for more than a year, and they just want to leave.
The world's Lydia Emanolidou speaking with us from Lesvos, Greece. Lydia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Marco.
It's already getting colder here in Boston. That means a lot more time indoors soon. For those of us in the Northern Hemisphere heading inside, it's kind of worrisome to think about how the coronavirus could spread. Preventing transmission indoors was the focus of our discussion on Facebook Live this week in collaboration with Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The world's Alana Gordon moderated the conversation and joins me. I got to tell you, Alana, there seems to be a lot of confusion around coronavirus transmission these days, especially when it comes to aerosols. Remind us, first of all, what are aerosols?
So, Marco, these are really small particles. They're like 1 to 10 microns in size. They can remain suspended in the air when you breathe them out, travel beyond 6 feet, and then inhaled by others. This is compared to the bigger droplets like when you sneeze. And this weekend, the CDC posted an update to the website and said, yes, this needs to be taken seriously. And Joe Allen is a professor of exposure assessment science at Harvard School of Public Health. And he said when he saw this, he was like, finally.
That's a landmark shift, because people in my field, myself included, since early February, have known that airborne transmission is happening. We've been yelling from the rooftops, trying to alert the world.
But then there was this big news earlier this week when the CDC removed the guidance and said it was posted by mistake.
That is confusing.
Totally. And even the WHO has moved the needle a little bit on this. The agency does now acknowledge that airborne transmission is happening. The point of debate in all this, Marco, is like just how common it is and where.
So, Alana, what is the current advice? Like, how do we make indoor spaces safer?
So here's where there's more clarity. Transmission of coronavirus is just a lot more common indoors compared to outdoors, a lot. And that's especially the case when you're in close proximity to other people. And of course, the longer the period, the longer the risk.
Right. That makes sense, because the big outbreaks we've been hearing about are often indoors.
Yeah, I mean, think about jails in Ohio, overcrowded housing in places like Mumbai, workers in a packed meatpacking plant in Germany. Those big droplets, or the small ones, they transmit more easily inside. And so acknowledging even the possibility of airborne transmission is important in what we can do. Here's Harvard's Joe Allen again.
It just means you have to add one more control to what you're doing already. Hand washing, masking, distancing. Just make sure you're also thinking about ventilation and filtration indoors to address this far field or longer range transmission that can happen.
So yes, distancing from others, that matters a lot. Wearing a mask matters. And then diluting and cleaning the air can further reduce those particles.
So if we're indoors, should we open a window?
Ventilation in simple terms means getting outdoor air in. Allen says in a home without that, it typically takes more than an hour for the air to fully change to clear out what's in it.
Hmm. What if it isn't possible to open a window? What if, you know, you live in a basement apartment, you don't have windows?
So Harvard's Joe Allen says there are other tools to help with this. You can use certain kinds of filters and ventilation systems. And finally, Marco, I want to add that even leaders like Dr. Anthony Fauci with the NIH, they've been shifting in acknowledging aerosols. So I want to just wrap up by playing a clip from The Daily Show with Trevor Noah from this week. Fauci responded to a fire hose of questions about what to do in different scenarios inside, including this one.
If you are in a movie theater, some people are going to movies around the country, and you're watching Christopher Nolan's new movie Tenet, right? And then there's only two people in the cinema. Do you put your mask on or do you keep it off?
Well, if they're so physically distanced away from you, you probably could keep it off. But remember, you got to be careful, because in the theater, if there's not good ventilation, there could be aerosol in that. Myself, what I would do, I would probably keep it on just to be safe.
All right, I got it, Dr. Fauci. Wear a mask and keep that fresh air circulating. The World's Ilana Gordon, thanks very much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
You can watch the full conversation with Harvard's Joe Allen and Ilana Gordon about ways to prevent the coronavirus from spreading indoors and explore the rest of our series. Head over to theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Across Italy, attention has turned to a recent murder outside of Rome. The victim was black. He was beaten to death by a group of white men. The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Willy Monteiro Duarte was born in Rome to parents from Cape Verde. He had just become an Italian citizen and at 21 years old was an aspiring chef at a hotel in a town near Rome. All that ended early this month when he tried to break up a fight and instead was beaten to death himself. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte attended Duarte's funeral, and hundreds marched in a candlelight procession to call for justice. Two white brothers were arrested in Duarte's death and have been charged with murder. Some believe they should also be charged for committing a hate crime. But that's where things get complicated.
Maybe another case would be absolutely a case of racism. But in this case, based on the facts that we know, we do not know at the end.
Giulia Perrin is an attorney with an Italian Association of Immigration Lawyers. She says there needs to be concrete evidence of racist motivations.
This could be done if, for instance, we know that at the moment of the killing, these boys were shouting, "You are black," or something. But that's not the case.
Others say that Duarte's death is evidence of growing fascism in Italy. Marcello Manieri is an assistant professor of sociology at the University of Milan Bicocca, who studies race and power.
Fascism in Italy has this history of the cult of the male body, the strong myth of Rome that ruled the world and so on, a myth of domination.
The brothers charged in Duarte's death have pleaded innocent. They're bodybuilders who are into mixed martial arts and have police records.
These people acted like they owned the community. They wanted to patrol their territory. In the end, I think that when they saw this black guy, they thought, we are the people who must control the territory, not him.
And that's a fascist instinct, he says. Judith Sunderland argues the brothers' behavior can be fascistic and racist. She's deputy director of Europe for Human Rights Watch, based in Milan.
Fascism, as it was developed and implemented and experienced here in Italy, had a very racist dimension to it.
And Sunderland says that while Italian law enforcement requires clear-cut indications to declare an attack racially motivated, that's not how racism often works in reality.
It's unfortunate that so much of the conversation has revolved around this insistence on, well, it's not racism. It was all these other things, but it absolutely wasn't racism, because that means that people aren't ready for the kind of reckoning that is necessary in order to really address systemic discrimination and racism in our societies.
Yet last week, Duarte's family released a statement saying they didn't want their son's death to be used as a political tool to talk about racism or fascism. They wrote, quote, "Willy was the victim of cruelty and unjustified ferocity, which had no color or race," unquote.
I understand why they did this statement. I think I can understand.
But it disappointed Ariam Tekle, a daughter of Eritrean immigrants. Her 2017 documentary explored the lives of children of immigrants in Italy. She doesn't know the Duarte family, but speculates that they were trying to fend off racist attacks online. Tekle believes if Duarte had died in the U.S., there would be a larger mainstream discussion about racism.
For me, it's obviously racist action. It's a bit dangerous saying that is not racist, because it is.
And she says, as long as Italians don't recognize racism, they won't be able to address it. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
A rigged election, violent government crackdown, and political repression orchestrated by Alexander Lukashenko, the president of Belarus for 26 years. Make that five more. Today, Lukashenko was sworn in for a sixth term in an unannounced ceremony. One opposition politician called it a secret meeting of thieves. Joining me is Franok Vyacharka. He's a Belarusian analyst with the Atlantic Council.
Starting from now, Lukashenko lost the remains of their legitimacy. He say, people, I don't care about your opinion. I will be the president for 5 more years. And perhaps this will radicalize protests.
Mm. You describe yourself, Franok, as a journalist, but you've also been part of the opposition movement to Lukashenko for years. We should note your father is also an opposition politician. You studied at an interesting school, the Belarusian Humanities Lyceum. What is that school and what does it stand for?
Belarusian Lyceum is the only school in Belarusian language, which was given independent knowledge on Belarus history and culture, and it was closed by Lukashenko. So we were studying in underground for many years, and this still exists. It works in underground, and many young and cool people are graduating from the school. Mm. So the school became like the nest of the new generation of pro-democracy activists of Belarus, and I think I am one of them.
These days it may be obvious, but why did Lukashenko shut it down?
You know, when Lukashenko came to power, he tried to sterilize the political, social, cultural sphere of Belarus. First, he dismissed the parliament. Many opponents were detained, arrested. Many journalists were killed. And in the 2000s, after he sterilized the political sphere, he started building power vertical, serving his own interests. He wanted every piece of the state to serve him. And now we have everyone dependent on Lukashenko. And this is why for protesters, it's so hard to crush the system. And I'm afraid that without destroying the system and the state by itself, it will not be possible to make the democratic revolution in Belarus.
Franok, how did your time studying at the Belarusian Humanities Lyceum and Lukashenko's dismissal of it, how did it influence your identity as a Belarusian citizen?
You know, I was like 14, 15 years old back then, and I didn't believe that Lukashenko will stay for so long. We were making jokes of him, we were mocking him, we were saying that, you know, Lukashenko, it's like the mistake of the history. And now, 15 years after, nothing really changed. The system's still in place, and we really underestimated the seriousness of the situation. So I think if I would know that this dictatorial regime, it will become so strong 15 years after, I would fight harder. I would be more active back then.
Franok, finally, you're on radio in the U.S. right now. What do you want to say to Americans? What do you think they should know about Belarus and the Belarusian people?
First of all, value your freedom and democracy. This is what inspires the whole world. For us, Belarusians, the United States was always the example, the model, the symbol of freedom. And we were always counting on America in terms of help, in terms of our fight for democracy. Recently, last years, America is not so active, unfortunately, in international affairs and in supporting democracies worldwide. But many people around the world really need proactive America. America built on values, built on ideas of personal freedom. And definitely value freedoms you have now, because it's very easy to lose. And it's very hard to fight it back.
That is an important thing to keep in mind. Franok Vyacharka, Belarusian analyst with the Atlantic Council, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour of the show. You're listening to The World. A ship's log was discovered in a closet in California. The book gives historians a closer look at the transatlantic slave trade.
It was right in front of me, and I could turn the pages and read the text. That sense of immediacy you feel being right in front of an artifact like that, that's quite unparalleled.
What we can all learn from a slave ship called the Mary, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. President Trump reminded supporters this week that he's been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize for the second time. With both nominations, Trump got the nod from a far-right lawmaker in Norway, well known for his anti-immigrant views. Among the far-right in Europe, Trump has proven to be a popular figure. Specifically, though, we wanted to know the actual impact Trump's time in office has had on populist parties on the far-right over there. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports from London.
Just hours after Donald Trump won the 2016 election, Marine Le Pen, one of France's leading far-right politicians, took to the stage at her party's headquarters in Paris.
Les Américains ont voté. Ils ont refusé le statu quo.
The Americans have voted, Le Pen said, and they've rejected the status quo. Next door in Germany, Frauke Petry, then leader of the far-right Alternative für Deutschland, or AfD party, declared on Twitter, "This night changes the USA, Europe and the world." And in Britain, Nigel Farage, the former UK Independence Party leader, linked the Brexit campaign to Trump's election in America.
You know, 2016 is going to be the year of two great political revolutions. I thought Brexit was big, but boy, this looks like it's going to be even bigger.
Before 2016 and the rise of Trump, it was almost unthinkable for far-right politicians in Europe to be looking towards the White House for inspiration.
The most remarkable development here is that Trump and what he stands for challenged their long tradition of anti-Americanism.
Sylvia Tashka is a history lecturer at Wayne State University in Detroit. She says in the past, American presidents mostly represented everything that the far right in Europe opposed.
Unrestrained capitalism, in other words, you know, a globalized free market economy and interventionist, some would say imperialist foreign policy. And then Trump came along and he challenged both of these stereotypes about the United States.
Tashka was born in Nuremberg, the city made infamous by the big Nazi party rallies of the 1930s, featuring Adolf Hitler. Watching the rise of Germany's far-right AfD party in recent years has been distressing for people like Sylvia Tashka, but not entirely surprising.
Germany always had a far-right element, even when I grew up. They were kept more under the lid, and the 2010s made it possible for these people to show their face more in public. That's how I look at it.
The AfD is not alone. The League Party in Italy and the Vox Party in Spain are two other far-right parties who've seen their support grow steadily in the last few years. But Dutch political scientist Cas Muthe, who's written a number of books about the far-right, says very little of this can be attributed to President Trump.
It's important to remember that far-right politics predates Trump both in the US, but particularly in Europe, by decades. And parties like the Austrian Freedom Party or the National Rally in France really don't have to look at Trump for ideological motivation. They actually have a much more developed ideological frame than Trump will ever have.
Muthe says Trump himself pays very little attention to the politics of Europe. But that's not the case with all of his diplomats.
Some of the US ambassadors in Western Europe have tried to normalize far-right parties. One can think of Richard Grenell in Germany, who was criticized for normalizing the AfD. And in the Netherlands, it's even stronger with US Ambassador Piet Hoekstra. And allegedly, Forum for Democracy leaders met with Piet Hoekstra at the US Embassy to discuss their plans for the future.
And then there's Trump's former strategist, Steve Bannon.
Bannon has been on a never-ending Euro trip, supporting far-right parties across the continent, and he's preparing for a long war to be waged from a 13th-century abbey in Calaparto, Italy.
Bannon's plans to open an academy promoting far-right ideology in that monastery outside of Rome is getting pushback from Italy's culture ministry. He also set up a think tank in Brussels aimed at supporting populist parties in Europe. But Bannon is hardly a driving ideological force here, says French political analyst Jean-Yves Camus. Parties like the National Front in France have been doing just fine on their own, Camus says.
When Steve Bannon tried to present himself as the man who could unite the extreme right in Europe, he forgot a very important thing. The National Front was a very strong party well before Steve Bannon became known in Washington, D.C. So basically, they did not need him.
But it's not just about political parties. Patrick Hermanson is with Hope Not Hate, a British group that campaigns against racism and extremism. He says Trump's election in 2016 gave a boost to far-right grassroots movements in Europe. Hermansen, who's originally from Sweden, went undercover for a year in 2017 to report on these groups in Europe and the US. He was at the protests in Charlottesville the day Heather Hare was killed in a car ramming attack by a man who espoused neo-Nazi and white supremacist beliefs.
I was right on that corner where it happened. So it happened right in front of me, yeah.
Hermansen says no one could have predicted Hare's death, but after spending months with these groups, he says he did expect that things could turn violent.
These people were increasingly willing to make use of violence. That became clear quite quickly. Based on how they speak, like you say, how it will soon be too late to save the UK or the US.
When Hermansen went public, revealing his year undercover, he received personal threats from far-right supporters for many months afterwards. Today, he says, he feels relatively safe. Looking to November 3rd, Hermansen says the far-right supporters he met across Europe will want to see Trump win a second term. Political scientist Cass Muthe agrees.
Trump will treat them at the very least the same as the others, as the mainstream parties, whereas Biden will probably be very much against the far right, not just in the US, but outside as well. So it makes perfect sense that they would prefer Trump over Biden.
Whoever wins the November election, though, all of the experts I spoke with agree that the far right in Europe is here to stay. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Now to Lebanon, where the state is barely functioning. The Lebanese currency is in free fall. Unemployment is above 30%. And politicians cannot agree on who should be in charge. Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, literally said this week that his country could be going to hell if a new government isn't formed soon. That was the president's quote, to hell. Aoun added there does not appear to be any solution on the horizon. Heiko Wimmen is with the International Crisis Group, where he's a project director for Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq. He's currently in Cairo. Heiko, what's the holdup with forming a new Lebanese cabinet?
So right now there's a tussle over who's going to get the Ministry of Finance, which clearly in a situation like this and when you need to talk to the IMF and all of this is a very crucial one. But the larger problem is... It's a struggle for influence. You have, of course, Hezbollah and you have other parties and that are struggling for influence in the next government. And how many ministers you are able to put in there means how much influence you have.
The Prime Minister of Lebanon, the designated Prime Minister, Mustafa Adib, recently proposed a shakeup of ministries, which in recent years, I understand, have been allocated according to Lebanon's sectarian government system. Do you see such a move happening, the shakeup?
The Ministry of Finance has been, that's the big price they're fighting now over,
right,
has been a so-called Shia ministry for now something like 5-6 years, I believe, if I'm not mistaken. It wasn't that before. The Lebanese system is actually not as inflexible as this would suggest. It's not like certain ministries are allocated to certain parties. But now with the system so much under pressure, the elites feeling themselves cornered, and you don't know where things are going between the US and Iran. You don't know who is going to be sitting in the White House next year and all of this. The likelihood that anybody is going to make any compromises, take any risks by being flexible appears quite low.
So you mentioned Hezbollah. It's considered by the US as a terror organization, but they've been receiving growing criticism, especially since the August port explosion in Beirut. Can you envision a government without Hezbollah?
Yes, but you cannot envision a government that Hezbollah agrees to and is, let's say, somewhat comfortable with. I mean, very simple, they are one of the two big Shia parties. They represent the Shiite community. The other party, Shiite party that is there, Amal, walks with them in lockstep, you know. So if you have those two big parties against you, against the government will not work because the system is built that way. The system is built in a way to make sure that none of the big communities can be excluded. You know? So you need to have them on board somehow.
Yesterday, there was a large explosion in the south of Lebanon. It left a large crater and caused damage to some buildings. The reports say it was a Hezbollah weapons depot that experienced a quote-unquote technical error. What is the local sentiment towards Hezbollah stocking weapons in populated areas?
The issue of Hezbollah's weapons is a very divisive one in Lebanon. If you ask people who are supportive of the party in general, then you will hear good explanations for things like that. Maybe some grumbling, but no condemnations. And if you ask people who are against the Hezbollah project, against their political line, you will, of course, hear the most fiery condemnations. You'll hear people coming up with narratives that supposedly prove that Hezbollah was even behind the port explosion. And the fact is, it is extremely divisive, and it really depends who you ask.
To hear about a political logjam just over a month since such a graphic illustration of dysfunction in the Lebanese government, the terrible and massive explosion at the Beirut port, is the government not listening to the people?
Well, I mean, for government to listen to the people, you need to have a government to begin with, and we don't have one right now. You can definitely say that the established existing political elite, the status quo parties, if you want, are not very good at listening to the people, and they're very good at blaming their opponents for everything that is wrong. I think I would say the political elite has in Lebanon still has gotten not received the message. They still don't understand that this game that they have been playing for 20 years is really up. You know? They're still playing by the old rules, but in the meantime, the country is sinking.
Heiko Wimmen with the International Crisis Group. He's the project director for Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq there. Thanks very much, Heiko.
Yalla. Thank you. Have a nice day.
In 1795, a ship called the Mary departed from Providence, Rhode Island. It was heading to cities along the West African coast in what are now the countries of Senegal, Liberia, and Ghana. A year later, it returned to the United States with 142 enslaved men, women, and children on board. We know this because it's written down in the logbook from the Mary. That book was recently discovered in a closet in California. It now has a new home at Georgetown University, where it's being digitized. Adam Rothman is a historian at Georgetown. When you first held this logbook in your hands, Adam, and looked through it, what were you feeling?
I was feeling, I guess, a kind of astonishment that such an artifact actually existed, and it was right in front of me, and I could turn the pages and read the text. There's that kind of immediacy, that sense of immediacy you feel being right in front of an artifact like that. That's quite unparalleled.
And I'm assuming pretty good condition. What does it look like?
It's a big book. It's like physically large and oversized manuscript. And so you really get a sense that there's, you know, it's something weighty. When it arrived, it was in pretty good condition, all things considered, but the pages were a little frayed, a little torn. The whole thing was quite fragile.
It's also emotionally weighty. There were 142 enslaved African people on board the Mary. We know that. Mm-hmm. What does the book tell us about them? What do we know about their lives?
Well, the book tells us almost nothing about them. It doesn't tell us their names. It doesn't tell us where they came from originally, you know, how they got onto the vessel of the Mary. All it tells us is that they were on board that vessel and that some of them, actually a shockingly large number of them, died during the Middle Passage. And the way those deaths are recorded in the logbook is probably the most shocking thing about it. All it says, you know, over and over, day after day, is, you know, boy died, buried at sea. Wow. That's it, you know.
Who kept this log? Was it a ship's captain, a slave trader? And do we get any insights into how that person was part of this abduction of people into slavery, this crime?
We don't know who actually kept the journal. It could have been the captain. It could have been a first mate or a ship's surgeon or something like that. What's unusual about this one is the level of detail that is provided day to day. You know, there's some standard stuff like what the weather was like. But then there's also a record of the transactions that take place on the West African coast, the kinds of goods that are bought and sold in exchange for people, and then this record of death and dying.
The log also documents some pretty incredible stories, speaking of detail, a number of mutiny attempts. What happened in those cases?
Yeah, it was a tumultuous voyage. The captain had some trouble with the crew and had to punish some of them. There was they were kind of disgruntled. But then the most serious mutiny that took place, if you can call it a mutiny, it's really an uprising or revolt, was of the captive Africans off the coast of West Africa. They try to free themselves from the hold of the ship and take over the vessel, but they're beaten down, gunned down by the crew. And it's narrated in incredible detail in the journal. You can kind of almost see the leader of the rebels emerging from the hold and, you know, trying to take over the ship, but he failed.
It's a wild story that the ship's log was found in a closet in California. Do you know how it ended up there, and how did it then get to Georgetown University?
It seems like this logbook has been in the family of probably the person who wrote it across generations as that family moved west. You know, we at Georgetown, we've been examining our own history of slavery as an institution very intensely for the last 5 years. There was a Georgetown student who was aware of what was going on, knew that a neighbor of his had this logbook, you know, in their family. And he basically, I think, talked to the neighbor and convinced him to give it to Georgetown.
How do these primary sources, like this ship's log, how do they change the way we think about the history of the Atlantic slave trade?
I think one of the most important lessons of the logbook has to do with how ordinary it is. It's an account in the most basic financial sense of the word. Perhaps on the deepest level, it tells us about the business practices, the routine business practices of the buying and selling of human beings, the transporting them thousands of miles across a trackless ocean at immense cost. Basically, one out of six or one out of seven captives transported across the ocean on the slave ships died en route. It's an astronomical human toll. And to see it recorded in such a callous kind of way in the logbook takes you deeper into the mentality of the slaving world.
Adam Rothman is a professor of history at Georgetown University in Washington. Thanks very much for describing this, for telling us about this logbook.
Thanks for having me.
Perhaps the biggest climate change news of the year came out this week. Chinese President Xi Jinping announced new carbon emission targets in a video address to the United Nations yesterday. He set a new long-term goal of reaching carbon neutrality before 2060. Here he is speaking to the UN through an interpreter.
We have to form quickly a green way of development and of life and build the ecological civilization and a beautiful earth.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, joins us now. Carolyn, considering this is the biggest climate news of the year, just how big of a deal is it?
It's a big deal, Marco, for two reasons I want to talk about. First, from a scientific perspective, China is by far the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. About a quarter of global emissions come from just that one country. So if China meets this target of reaching carbon neutrality before 2060, that could actually have a big impact on how much our world warms. It could reduce global warming by as much as half a degree Fahrenheit, according to the Climate Action Tracker, which, you know, that might not seem like a huge amount, but it actually makes a really big difference. And then aside from this science, this climate science, this announcement's also important on the diplomatic front.
How so? Explain that.
Well, China and the U.S. together back in 2014 joined together to pave the way for the Paris Agreement. So they made this bilateral pact to cut emissions, announced it, and that sort of paved the way for the Paris Agreement. When the U.S. announced in 2017 that it was going to be pulling out of the Paris Agreement, there was this concern that, you know, with the U.S., the world's largest historical emitter, basically saying, we're not going to be a leader on climate change, China also wouldn't feel like it needed to do that anymore. China has long seen itself as having less historical responsibility to tackle this problem. And with this announcement from Xi Jinping, China is really stepping up and saying, we're going to be a global leader on this issue.
So this is a big shift for China. How real is the target, though? I mean, is this just talk from Xi Jinping? Because 2060 is a long way off.
It is, and we have no details beyond, you know, one line in a speech. So there's a lot of excitement and hope from the climate world around this surprise announcement, but there's also some skepticism. So two things to watch going forward. China will submit a new nationally determined contribution, so a new carbon-cutting target officially through the Paris Agreement process sometime next year. So we can look for details there. And we'll also have more details when China unveils its next five-year economic plan, which will govern the country's economic trajectory and energy starting in 2021.
What are you going to be watching out for moving forward, Carolyn, to see if this is really real?
A couple of things, both in terms of this announcement and then what China does domestically. First, what exactly Xi Jinping means here by carbon neutrality. That term usually refers to carbon dioxide, getting that down to net zero, and not other greenhouse gases. So what exactly he means by that. Also, how much before 2060 he plans to reach that target. Scientists say we need to be at net zero before that, by 2050, to reach the Paris Agreement goals. And then on the domestic side in China, if near-term policy changes really match the ambition of this 2060 target, and another tweak in policy that he announced yesterday, hitting peak CO2 emissions before 2030 instead of around 2030, which was the previous goal. Some background here on China. Emissions there are still on the rise, and it's still permitting and building lots of new coal plants. So domestic energy policy will be another key thing to watch.
Right. We should remember, too, that some of the things to watch out for are not in China. China's a serious financial backer of energy projects well outside its borders.
That's right. And it's not clear if or how this new target would impact decisions China makes on financing energy or infrastructure projects outside of China. For example, the $1 trillion global infrastructure project, the Belt and Road Initiative. So, you know, emissions from a coal-fired power plant that China finances outside of the country don't count toward its carbon emissions, but obviously emissions know no borders. So these are all things to watch going forward.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Every weekday morning, the team here at The World discusses the most important stories that we need to cover. You can also get a seat at the table. Subscribe to our daily newsletter, Top of the World, to find out what's top of our minds each day. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. There are occasionally sparks of joy that arise from the worst of circumstances. Not too many of those in the midst of a pandemic, though. So when one comes along, we gotta let you know about it. This one actually happened in the same town where Shakespeare created the setting for Romeo and Juliet, Verona, Italy. A man and a woman on separate balconies for a concert in the city. They did not know each other. Now they do. Sit down and let me regale you with the tale in iambic pentameter. In fair Verona, their lives are seen. Two single people, one girl and one boy, stood on their balconies waiting to sing. In March 2020, they were both locked down. Evenings were spent to choruses of Queen. We Are the Champion soon was their theme as the girl's sister played the violin strings. Love soon bloomed, and as lockdown eased, they met in a park for their first big squeeze. No star-crossed lovers, he took to his knees, and Verona's balconies rejoiced in glee, cheering on the new bride and groom-to-be. Yes, Michele Dalpaos, 38, and Paola Agnelli, 40, are now engaged. A little iambic pentameter composed by an old friend of the show, Jamie Rogers, who's also a Shakespearean scholar. We've got the whole love story in modern English prose at The World's Twitter feed. We are at The World. Earlier this hour, we told you about the reaction in Belarus to the surprise secret inauguration today of President Alexander Lukashenko. Despite sustained weeks of protests, his victory was rigged. Protesters say the winner of that election is actually Svetlana Tikhanovskaya.
And this government will never respect us because for more than 20 years it didn't. They will never think about our people as people, as, you know, as unity. We just were working power for them.
Tikhanovskaya is currently in exile in Lithuania. Tomorrow, Tikhanovskaya will be our guest on the show to talk about what comes next for Belarus's protest movement. That's going to do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks very much for making it today. We'll see you back here tomorrow. From PR.